a call from the local paper, from the Renewed Gazette. The young reporter wanted to come up and do, I heard the story, the papers were there. And because I was a University of Nevada graduate and used to work for the Renewed Gazette, I was going to come up and do a story on the papers. When he finished examining them at length, he wrote a little memo, said, the only thing I can see is he was kind of job applicants.
You know what I found so interesting in your papers? I read, for example, your you spoke to the graduating class. You in 19, I don't know when it was. You were the commencement speaker for the graduation.
Oh yeah, I think it was about in 67.
The war was going sour though, and you had to figure out a way to impart a message to these young people, but also let them know that the war was going south.
Yeah.
And you did that in a very delicate way. It took you know, and you worked your way up to it, and you know, and it was a very good speech, I thought.
I don't have a copy of that.
You don't?
No.
Oh.
I don't care that much. Sorry.
So let me ask you a few.
Sure.
I have some questions about what the best thing in your, I wanted to ask you about the interview, I'll get to that too. But in your papers, something that I did learn a lot about was your help for with getting Yangon into the country, okay? And you're working with Bob Anson. I know that, and I have a lot of documentation already.
Yeah.
Do you have any contact information, by the way, on Anson? Do you know where Bob is right now?
Last I knew, he was in Long Island, but I don't know if he's still there or not.
Yeah. So he's not. But I'll
is that right?
Yeah.
No, I don't know where Bob is. We fell out of touch.
Here's something I don't understand, which is there's two things I wanted to ask you about. One is, as you were raising the money, and you and Bob were raising the money, there was this big issue, and the big issue had to do with you had to get somebody to guarantee the loan, okay, be the guarantee of the fact. And finally, the president of the University of North Carolina, Spangler, C.D. Spangler, gave $2,000 and guaranteed the loan.
Right, right.
And why did he do that? I mean, did you have a relationship with him, or did Anson?
No, I tell you what I think it was, and this is, I'm theorizing, but I'm reasonably sure this is it. For reasons totally unrelated to Ahn and his family, a sizable Vietnamese community of students and part of them, sometimes their families, had built up around the university.
Oh, really?
And so the university was receptive to the idea of another Vietnamese, and that's the only thing I can account for. I remember how delighted we were, but
right. Yeah, it's unusual for a president of the university.
But again, that was my. I know that they had a lot of Vietnamese students, that they were pleased with all of them, that all of them had done very well, and I think that. That's the context within which he did this.
So, one of the things I found was, because he knew, I mean, obviously he must, those Vietnamese students, I bet, were from the South, that is, the community in North Carolina, mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden, he was pulling all these strings and making something happen for the son of a communist spy.
Mm-hmm.
Surely something that wouldn't make Yangon a friend of the community.
No.
And he paid $2,000 out of his own money, and my hypothesis on this, and I want to talk to Anson about this too, is there's two things. And one is, though, that I gather that Yangon stayed in the home of Anson's mother-in-law, Miss Kaiser. And apparently she was very tied in with the university, and and herself had
included money.
Given money, and perhaps
money.
That was the reason. I don't know. I want to ask.
That's true.
On that. Okay. Now,
so there was those, put those two together. There was a foundation there for the admission of another. As a matter of fact, I've often wondered what kind of greeting Ahn had there, but apparently nothing went wrong, you know, I mean, because these were all Southern Vietnamese kids, and I wondered but apparently nothing went
wrong.
Right. It was all pleasant enough.
He said it was all pleasant enough, but he played low. Now, the other thing that I learned from going through your papers about the period of getting Ahn here was that Anson was constantly writing you, referring to, using this term, pigeoning letters, which I know means, you know, and so there were two people who were pigeoning letters. One was Allison Krupnik, who worked for the U.S. Department of State, you might recall her, the other was Judith Ledinsky, who also was helping out, and she was from the University of Wisconsin. But one of the things that comes out in his letters to you is that Ahn Senior, is really playing a major role in all this too, that he's orchestrating a lot of this, and he's sending faxes and the like. Interesting.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. I have no doubt of that at all.
Yeah.
No, that's right.
And he had to be,
I don't know where Robert Sam is.
Yeah, I've written him in two different places already. I've been told to write him at the New York Observer, where he's a correspondent.
Yeah.
And then, not Vogue, somewhere else. But he doesn't have a listed phone number.
Do you have an address?
I had one originally in Long Island, but that's not. Yeah, I got some return. Stanley Carno tells me he knows where he is, and he'll track him down for me.
Yeah.
Well, you know, he just signed a big contract. It was in the paper.
Bob,
to write a book on Dick Cheney.
Woo!
Yeah. The secret life of Dick Cheney.
Oh man, let me get on the list.
Yeah, exactly. Now, the other thing that is puzzling to me is Anson, Bob, sent to you a letter from Douglas Pike from Berkeley, who's now passed away. And I knew Doug very well. And he said that the gist of Pike's concern was there's no way Hanoi is going to let this guy out. He can't even get his own students out.
Yeah.
Meaning Pike can't get his students out.
Right.
How are you going to get the son of a spy out?
Yeah, right.
And so I'm curious, just your own reflections as to why Hanoi in 1990, when it was very hard to get out, why would they let young Ahn out when they know how much, they wouldn't let his father out because they didn't want him to have contact with the West.
Right.
Why would they let his son have contact? I mean, it's such a shitty government. I mean, it's such a, the communist government,
I think that makes perfect sense. I think what Hanoi was thinking is, let's favor the old man a little here. Let's do something, see if we can't shut him up.
Okay. Shut him up and keep him here, but let his son go.
Yeah, keep him here, but shut him, get him off our backs by doing him a huge favor. That was always my theory.
Okay.
Because I wanted to do the same thing. And I finally concluded that I can't think of any other reason they would have done it.
I'm still working on, like a good reporter, I'm still working on this conclusion because there's another Anson cable to you on September 10th that says, it says dated September 10th, it says, Ahn is now coming under increased surveillance. And we are now very worried about, even if his son is allowed to go, whether or not he'll be tailed all the time by Hanoi.
By the North, yeah.
And he refers to this guy who, I don't know who he is. His name is Tran Van, former two guy and close Ahn friend.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Do you remember him?
Yeah,
Okay.
He was one of the early pacification guys. I mean, very early in the war. he was there. Maybe 49 to 53 or something like that, very early in the war. He was in pacification down in the Delta. And I think he was in Verde Games. I think he was in the piano wire division. I'm not sure of that, but I always believe that.
Interesting. All right, well, so, you know, Van was carrying, what Van's job was, he was going back and forth, and so he was pigeoning letters from Ahn to Bob.
Yeah.
So you can see I'm trying to put all this together and
Well, again, as you said, Ahn played this game very, very well. He very, very intelligently, very, very subtly, very shrewdly.
Now, the fact that you raised all this money indicates to me that my conclusion to all this is it shows how much people cared about Ahn.
No doubt about it.
Yeah.
I, we sure wouldn't have got that for Boy Jim's son or for Two's son or for any other. This was a response far on. I think the very first sentence, published sentence about Ahn's role was in Stan Karno column in about 76, 77, over there.
Really?
Yeah. I've asked Stan where he got it and I've forgotten what he said. You know, where did he pick that up? Because he was, Stan didn't spend an awful lot of time in Vietnam, and he was, by that time, had been stateside for years. I don't know where he picked it up.
I will, I'll ask Stanley.
Yeah.
On that. You could find a lot of references to him beginning about 78, 79, but I've never been able to document the first one, so...
Stan's first mention was about 77.
Must have been after his family came back then.
Yeah. He was back writing a domestic column.
Okay.
I can't remember who syndicated it, who it was for.
But do you have any theory as to why Beverly Deep doesn't speak to Ahn? She's the one person, well, there's a couple, but she's the one who just went, and they were very close at one time, you know?
No.
No.
I don't.
Did you know her?
Yeah. Not well, but I know her. I was always suspicious of Beverly. I thought she was in the agency.
You did?
Yeah, I thought she was she may have been an agency asset and not in the agency. Her tightness was total. And I was always a little suspicious of her.
Well, a lot of people thought Ahn was in the agency, too.
Yeah. Well, he skirted that edge. I bet you Mickey bet if he'd have pushed for it, he could have got hired by the agency.
Again, off the record, it's just between you and me.
Yeah.
In my book, I have two. He has told me two details. He was offered two jobs, twice they recruited him.
Yeah.
Once, the greatest irony is once right after Tet.
Yeah.
And of course, he had gotten a VC Heroes Medal for contributing to the victory at Tet. And then right afterwards, you know who offered him the job?
Uh-huh.
Colby.
Yeah.
So twice they tried to recruit him. And once they even offered to set him up as a landowner, they wanted to make him a plantation owner.
Yeah.
And they wanted him to basically watch VC infiltration by sea and things and the like. But in both times he was able to say no.
Yeah.
One time, the first offer, which is already written up, and I look forward to getting your reaction when you read it, which would be what the CIA offered him was that it would keep his job at Time Magazine and he would get the best scoops. They would give him the best stories in return for him being a spy for them.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, and that one he got out of it too.
It doesn't shock me.
Yeah.
That's for sure. But my guess on that is Ahn still, and so valued what he saw to be the ethics and values of good journalism that he wouldn't do that.
Right. I wouldn't do it. I think he was afraid of getting killed by the VC.
But I think the positive was there too.
So one of the things I found, actually, I want to ask you to tell me a little about someone. The office manager at Time Magazine, Nguyen Thi Dang.
Nguyen Thi Dang.
Yeah, you remember him?
Yeah, oh sure.
Tell me a little about him, if you don't mind.
Let's see. How did I find Dang? I have to admit I can't remember how I found him. But as as the war grew and the bureau grew, we just the administrative details inside the bureau were getting away from us, including somebody knowledgeable enough to hire the Vietnamese help we needed. And so I just can't remember how I found Dang. He spoke English very well, very quiet, very competent. And so so I hired him immediately, and then immediately turned over the internal operation of the Bureau to him. And he was superb. You know, he was exactly what I hoped he would be. And all the, for 7 or 8 years then, 6 years at least, all the Vietnamese employees who came there came through Dang.
An really liked him also. An admired him, actually.
Yeah.
Respected him.
Yeah.
And actually said he thought he also was working in security, but I don't think that's true.
No.
And there's a beautiful letter dated December 13th, 1967 from Dang to you as you're leaving.
Yeah.
And it says, "You have our admiration, love, respect, and gratitude."
Yeah.
I don't know what else to say, but you are the most respected one we have ever met in our life. Once again, I'm with you forever. Very beautiful.
Yeah, nice.
Did he get out?
Yeah.
Okay.
He's living in New Jersey.
Yeah.
When I left, it was a tough day, a tough moment. So I was down at the Bureau and couldn't figure out, what am I going to do? What am I going to say goodbye? Why? Well, so we had a football down there, and we used to play touch tackle out in that park next to the cathedral. And much to the amazement of the Vietnamese, said that we were all mad playing touch tackle in the heat. But in any event, we had this football.
I have this in my book, by
the way. Oh, did
you? Not this story. I had the fact that you initiated football games.
Oh, yeah.
And the kids used to play with you all the time. Yeah.
So I had to stand there, and I put my hand in the football. Look, the big plate glass window in the front of the Bureau. A little villa. And Dang said, "Yeah." So I threw the football through the glass window. Smashed it all out. And I said, "I'll be seeing you," and left.
that's great. So you knew Luke Conin fairly well,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
so,
pretty well.
Someone gave me some papers of Luke Conin.
Mm-hmm.
I have to protect my source.
Yeah.
But I have received some really great stuff passed to me in Conin's own writing and also tape recordings and the like. So this is what he had to say about An, which is really great, and I wanted to get your reaction to it. Two things, but there's one in particular I want to read to you. I have the other things, but what Conin said, I could paraphrase it because I know it by heart, is that Lou had great respect for that son of a bitch An, because how he could have pulled it off, a double life like that, it was one spy to another. He said, how he did it, he still doesn't know, because the pressures, not making a mistake all that time, especially around people like Conin and others, he said he has to hand it to the guy. How could he have done it?
That's one spy to another. That's nice. Lou was one of the originals who tried to argue with policymakers that Ho Chi Minh could be brought over. Because Lou was in North Vietnam for...
Yeah.
That whole group was up there. And Lou felt that very strongly and argued it. He tried to kill Lansdale one night in Saigon. I was at dinner with Lou, and we were up at the top of the wrecks. Somebody leaned over the restaurant was on top floor on the roof. Somebody leaned over and said, "Hey, here comes Lansdale." Lou said, "Where?" And he said, "Down here in the street." And Lou went over and got a potted palm and watched him and dropped it. Just missed him about that far.
That fits. Yeah, here's the exact quote. This is Conin. "I couldn't help but admiring An for pulling it off all those years. for maintaining his self-control and never making a slip. My admiration is of one professional intelligence officer to another who had played the same role. I can't help but admire the guy about how skillful he was at this job.
Well, you know, nothing, you know, the bullshit that Han was there spreading communist propaganda through Time magazine. To me, another remarkable thing out of it, he never made that kind of error, not once. You know.
Right, he never made that kind of error, but let me tell you, Conin does argue that he did shape Time magazine's articles, and I'll tell you how. It's very bit, only through Bob Shapland, and I'll tell you how.
Yeah.
By the way, do you buy this argument, or you probably heard it, that Shapland was CIA, was with the CIA? And
no, we had a lot of influence with him, but Chaplin was not with the
Chaplin,
CIA.
Chaplin, yeah, all right.
No.
Shapland or Chaplin?
Chaplin.
Chaplin. You know, his son's out here, Peter.
I'm
going to go look him up. He's got a web page, and he lives right here in the Bay Area.
Yeah, he worked for one of the TV stations here. I don't know if he still does or not.
Oh. You knew Vung, right?
I was one of my best friends.
Is it true that, according to Conin, he was a heavy opium user? Is that correct?
He was an opium user. I wouldn't say he was a heavy opium user.
Okay, all right.
Hell, at one time or another, everybody tried opium.
This is Lou's.
No, that's wrong.
Okay, all right. So here's what Lou. This is how Conin says on influence time or journalists reporting,
mm-hmm.
and in particular Shapa. Okay, so this is not Time now, but this is Shapa.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to get your reaction to it. According to Conin, there were times that he would go out to see Tri Quang.
Dick Tri Quang.
Yeah, your man right here. For an interview. But when the interview appeared in print, it bore no resemblance to what Conin had heard. Why was that? Because An and Vung, Shapland would go see An and Vung and show him what Tri Quang had said. And they would say, and this is a quote, "Well, he said that, but this is what he really meant. This is what he was really saying." And then Bob would write it the way An told him, not the way Tri Quang said it. When Conin challenged him, Shapland would say, "But that's what he meant, Lou, even though if he didn't say it, that's what An tells me." And then Conin continues. I'll just stop there.
Yeah, well, I know what Bob was talking about. One of the things you learned is, if you did anything in politics, that don't, you very, very seldom accept anything at face value when it's said in public. There's a second, third, fourth, fifth meaning to it, which the insiders know. And that's the reason that you would ask on, what did Tri Quang really mean by that? Was there a danger in that? Sure. Sure, but on the other hand, you could be, if you went the other way and went with what appeared to be the facts, boy, could you wind up wrong. I remember one time when who was Prime Minister? Kind of the Prime Minister, and Tri Quang praised him highly. And so, wow, this is the first Prime Minister to get Buddhist support. And I don't know whether it was on or not, but anyway, maybe it was Dang. I said, no, wait a minute, read this a little more carefully. Here's what he's really saying. You know, it's what appear to be to us Westerners subtleties of all Asians. And they all understand it. But I acknowledge there's you can get trapped in that. Where's Lou?
He's dead.
Oh, he's dead?
Lou Conin?
Yeah, didn't he?
Yeah, he died several years ago, actually.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, and his wife is best friends with Jolene.
Yeah.
And Ruth Phillips and everyone, they all still get together. So.
Yeah.
Do
you remember Rufus Phillips?
Yeah, sure.
See, he's been very valuable to me, and he was, of course, working with Lansdowne. Conan's dead, long dead.
Yeah.
But,
Lou's last job was running the anti-dope agency.
Right, yeah.
I guess he wanted to bring the piano wire practices to that. That didn't last very long.
He was a wild guy.
He's a wild man.
An liked him a lot.
Yeah.
And An has given me great stories about Conan. For example, there were times when Conan had a suspicion. Conan's the best example.
Yeah.
That Conan was making overtures to the NLF, mm-hmm. okay, or with the enemy.
Yeah.
So Conan got a wind of this and went and got on and said, "On, get your family, get out of here. The country's going down. We're gonna have to take care of Conan now."
Yeah. See, that fits with the thing I was telling you about that Tri Quang was praising him. No, he wasn't. He was giving the signal that we're going to get this guy. Of course, Conan, he just had no leadership or administrative abilities.
Right.
He was a funny little guy. I loved following him around Vietnam. But there was no way.
Did you know Tien at all?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, what was your impression of him?
Very, very smart, very sly, and you were never... See, I keep measuring people as a journalist, but you're never going to get anything out of him that he didn't want to do.
Interesting that he, Tien, and Conan, both of them, Lu Conan and Tien,
yeah.
both in intelligence, had no clue about An and knew An very well.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just that journalists.
No, Uga, no, that's right. I had to give a little speech here 2 days ago, and I was going to use this, and I didn't. One time, the North Vietnamese had, or Viet Cong, I don't know which, had destroyed a hamlet up somewhere up near Da Nang. And so the keys, Nguyen Cao Ky and Mai, took his jet and flew up there to inspire the surviving villagers to stay with him, you know, stay with the war. And there was a young captain, a U.S. Marine captain, who was advisor to the South Vietnamese Marine unit that had fought the North Vietnamese there. So they were still out patrolling when the Keys came. The Keys came in their black silk jumpsuits with the purple scarves, and got out of the plane and sort of stood there, you know. They didn't walk around anyway. And this U.S. Marine captain and his patrol came bursting out of the brush. He was absolutely startled. He didn't know there was anybody there. And he looked at the Keys, and he said, very loudly, he said, "Jesus Christ, it's Captain and Mrs. Midnight out to see the war." On the way back to Saigon, Key says, "Who is Captain Midnight?" And I said, "Oh, he's an American hero."
Well, I have to go see if the story is in Key's new book, Buddha's Child. Key has a new book out, about a year old now, called Buddha's Child.
Yeah.
And my friends who don't like Key, Vietnamese friends who don't like Key,
yeah.
always say, yes,
yeah.
if he's Buddha's child.
Yeah. They were a pair. One time, Mai heard that Key was up in the Highlands, anyway. All those names are slipping away from me. Up in the Highlands with a new lady friend. So after she got the information, she went straight out to Tansanut, commandeered a young Marine fighter pilot, or a young Vietnamese fighter pilot, and his plane, and told him to fly her to up to the Highlands with them. Where they grew all the vegetables. It was a resort town, it was kind of, you know, a Vietnamese resort town. Anyway, fly him up there, and she, by God, she's going to...
Deluxe.
That did a lot. Thank you. That did a lot. And she was going to pin him down right there. Well, the young pilot had some pretty good idea what this was all about. So, as they were approaching the Dalat airstrip, he told the tower not to give him permission to land. Keep him off. So, he duly reported this to Mai. And Mai said, okay. Yep, he was back. Turned around, got the machine guns, and she said, now, I want you to run up, you know. She strafed the airstrip. All the way up and all the way back.
What a character. Yeah.
She was a beautiful woman.
Yeah.
Woo!
You know, and you know, Key now wants to go back to live in Vietnam, and he's buried in Vietnam, and he's really he's made peace with the homeland, and he goes back now quite often.
Yeah.
And, it's interesting, because he's really...
Well, you know, Key was a born entrepreneur.
Yeah,
I don't know. One time off.